sponsored by JMR Rentals, jmrny.com.
Hello and welcome to No Rest for the Weekend. I'm Jason Godby, and today on the program, we're talking Dune Part 2. And joining me via Zoom, we got two of our favorite movie fans. We got No Rest for the Weekend's own Mary Beth Thewison and our man in Hollywood and the man behind ActuallyPaid.com, Mr. William Hammond. Welcome, guys.
Hey, Jason. Good to be here.
Hey.
We got the Dream Team back. We haven't done this for a minute, the three of us, I think. Normally we do, you know, when we review movies, we do like a 2-3, sometimes a handful, but this was so much movie that I wanted to dedicate a whole show to it. And we all saw it. So the first thing I want to know is how you guys saw the film. Mary Beth, where did you see it? Did you just go IMAX, regular screen?
I saw it on a regular screen, but it was a large screen. I recommend seeing it on the largest screen you can find.
And what about you, Bill?
I took it in on IMAX, which is a huge contrast because the last one I had to watch on my TV when it went to streaming. So the difference is almost literally night and day.
It was interesting because I went to Lincoln Center. Lincoln Center had a retrospective of Denis Villeneuve films as well as some that he curated. So I ended up seeing Blade Runner 2049, and Dune Part 1 on the big screen there. And Mary Beth and I had reviewed the first one back in 2021 when it came out. But then when I saw it again, I was like, I don't feel like I saw this movie. Like, I don't feel like I even experienced this. Like, I feel like I saw a facsimile of it kind of thing. I didn't feel like I saw the movie. And then I saw the movie on the big screen and I went, oh my God. About a week later, I think I saw Dune Part 2. And oh my God, that was even more movie than the first movie. So there's a lot of movie to talk about here. Mary Beth, you're the best at summarizing things. Why don't you give us a brief of Dune Part 1 and then tell us a brief of Dune Part 2, if you can.
Well, I'll try. It's all about the spice. Spice is a substance secreted by the giant sandworms on the desert planet Arrakis. It's essential for space travel. It has mind-expanding properties for those who are sensitive to it. So it's the most valuable substance in the universe. And as we're told at the beginning of Dune Part 2, power over spice is power over all. And everybody wants that power. So in the first Dune, the emperor asked Duke Leo Atreides to go to Arrakis to be the governor there and oversee the spice mining operation. So he goes with his significant other, the Bene Gesserit sister, Lady Jessica, and their son, Paul. But this is only a ruse to allow the Harkonnens, the former governors, to eliminate the Atreides once and for all. The Harkonnens attack, Duke Leto is killed, and Paul and Jessica are forced to flee to the desert. And they take refuge with the indigenous Arrakis people, the Fremen. So in part two, Paul is learning the ways of the desert from the Fremen people, particularly Chani, who he falls in love with, and Stilgar. And he ends up leading guerrilla attacks against the Harkonnen's spice mining operations, the machines and the soldiers who guard them. Meanwhile, Lady Jessica has the opportunity to become a Fremen Reverend Mother. She has to do so by imbibing the toxic water of life, which is also derived from the worms. She survives the experience and becomes a Reverend Mother, but she's pregnant. And that water of life breaches that placental barrier and affects her unborn fetus, who then has the mind of an adult while she's still in utero. She and Jessica plot to avenge Duke Leto and to get power for Paul. They use a Fremen prophecy about a Messiah who will come to free the Fremen people from their oppressors, which had been planted by the Bene Gesserit generations ago. In the meanwhile, the Harkonnens are not taking this lying down. They want to get rid of these Fremen attackers. And so they try to prevent it, to attack them and prevent it from happening, but they don't have much success against these guerrilla attackers. So the leader of the Harkonnens, the Baron, tasks one of his nephews, Fade Rautha, who's the psychotic guy, to take over the job. Meanwhile, Paul is having dreams in which he sees millions of people killed because of actions he takes, because of him, because he has accepted this Messiah prophecy. So he is fighting against this fate, but things spiral out of control and he can't resist it forever.
You know, the one thing, I'm so glad you wrote the review for us, because I felt like I was like, this movie, this doesn't need a review. It needs a syllabus. Like it's so much movie. What were your first impressions of it? What was the thing that knocked you over about it?
Well, it's just full of spectacle. Some people I know who watched the first Dune liked it, but thought it was a little slow, you know, not much was happening. I said, wait till the second one. And sure enough, like I say in my review, it's just more. A lot of people have used the words epic, but you've got everything in there. You've got more battles, more explosions, more worms, more Bene Gesserit, just everything. And the first one was a feast for the eyes and ears. This one, even more so. It's spectacular.
Bill, what did you think of it?
The big thing for me in both films is the sense of scale. Like, you really do feel like you're in another world when you're watching these films. The way Denis Villeneuve and his effects team just construct everything from the tiniest grain of sand to these gigantic war machines and sandworms, you always get a sense of where you stand, whether you're, you know, doing a silly walk through the desert to avoid the worms or watching that tiny little Muad'Dib kangaroo mouse just flittering about. You almost feel like you could reach out and grab a handful of the sand and see the particles of spice melange within it. And it's never done in a way that's too flashy. A lot of the effects are a really great mix of digital and practical, subtle changes with the color palette to, you know, turn their eyes blue when the spice affects them. The introduction scene for Fade Rautha in this washed out gladiator arena where it's all done in black and white, but it's not a complete digital effect. They really did cake Austin Butler in this insane amount of white makeup and a black outfit, you know, to do these scenes. And I think they shot those in Abu Dhabi. So it was like 130 degrees when they're doing this. The first film was very dense. It was a lot of table setting. There were so many characters to keep track of. There's still a little bit of that in this movie, but there's a whole lot more cutting to the chase. Like, we only have a couple of new characters in this film, Fade Rautha, the Emperor, his daughter, that we really need to keep track of. Everybody else we were already established with, and we can kind of just watch their journey unfold now. And that really aids in the immersive, almost interactive process of not just seeing this movie, but in experiencing it.
They shot most of it in a real desert. You could feel the heat coming off of this, you know, like you really could. I don't know if it was seeing it on the big screen or mainly because you get more into the characters in part two, but in the first Dune, I really didn't feel much for the characters. I really was like, okay, this is a bunch of rich people doing, you know. And then my sort of point of contact, my point of empathy was the Zendaya character. I felt for her the most, and I felt for, because she's trying to do the right thing by her people, but she's also in love with Paul. But you can see that she sees that this is going downhill quick, and, you know, there may be nothing left of her planet, of her relationship. I didn't realize it at first, but I was like, that's actually the sympathetic character.
That was one of the major points that Villeneuve did in altering the source material and departing from the previous version from the 80s that David Lynch did. He made Chani into a much more fully realized character with agency and a perspective of her own, rather than her just being the love interest.
I also have to call out the other two really good performances here, which is Timothy Chalamet as Paul and Rebecca Ferguson as Jessica, because they both go much deeper into these characters this time around than last time. Rebecca Ferguson was great last time, but she's even better now. She's so ruthlessly manipulative. She just lets nothing stand in her way. And Timothy Chalamet, you know, goes to, I feel like a deep, darker place than we've ever seen him go before. And you can tell that the expectations everyone has of him are just wearing on him.
Let's talk about some of the themes, because I don't think religion does great for the, in this movie. You know, there's a lot of allegories. I mean, I kept seeing stuff like, of course, the Middle East. That's the biggest one. You know, people have compared spice with oil for forever. It's Afghanistan. It's Vietnam. It's, you know, all of these, what happens when you mess with an indigenous people type warfare.
Well, you know, this is one reason I think that Dune continues to be so popular. There was a series of six novels to start with that were written by Frank Herbert. And it's because it's not just, you know, space cowboys. It's really weighty, real world stuff that goes on in there. Colonialism and, you know, all of its horrible effects, like you just mentioned. And then religion. Boy, in the books after this, religion is a really big deal. Here we see how a religion starts. There's a hero, the hero becomes a legend, and then the legend becomes a god, and a religion starts, and it's out of control. You see the beginnings of that here with this prophecy. Some of the Fremen think that Paul is their foretold Messiah, and they believe in him. Others, like Chani, don't. She's really suspicious of all of this. So, the religion comes in for a real dissection.
She even says, she's like, this prophecy is how they enslave us. It's not subtle, you know, but it's effective. That's another reason why I think I sympathize with her character, because she's in this world where she sees all of these people with this blind belief, especially Javier Bardem's character, who was, he doesn't get much to do in the first film, though I thought he was very good. He gets a lot to do in the second film, and man, is he great. He really sells that zealot kind of, and he's not, you feel like there's an innocence to him in that zealotry too. You don't feel like he's proselytizing to, you know, self-aggrandizing himself or anything like that.
He's not doing it for power. He's doing it because he really believes this will free his people.
True believer, yeah.
One of the biggest criticisms I usually have with religious films is that whatever the messianic or fundamentalist or dogmatic angle is, that's taken as read, that's taken as a given, that as an understood truth that you start from, rather than asking the questions and seeing how you can come by these beliefs. This film, on the other hand, does show that there's the very real perceptions of colonialism and manipulation that the Bene Gesserit do, that Jessica does, that Chani sees. But you also see someone like Stilgar, who comes by his fanaticism quite honestly. It's like, and there is weirdly a positive result from that, because it is a unifying force for the Fremen to get them to unite behind Paul and fight the good fight and basically put their tribal differences aside for the sake of this common goal. I mean, there's been a lot of memeing of Stilgar's character, you know, the fact that Paul says he's not a Messiah, and then he goes, see, he's too humble to say that. Like, it's Life of Brian almost. It's like the Messiah says he's not the Messiah. No, he's a very naughty boy. But again, you can see how people are led and how some others actively choose this angle, whether it's delusional or not. They choose it because it gives them something to cling to. And that is worthwhile and valuable. I love, as you said, it's not subtle, but it is very nuanced. And I'm very appreciative of that as someone who is not religious and has an objection to religious angles in films sometimes. This is the way you're going to do it if you're going to do it.
You know, the other thing, speaking of the religious aspect, is the Bene Gesserit mother is Charlotte Rampling. When you first see her, you're like, wow, she's a force to be reckoned with. She has that first scene with Paul, where, you know, put your hand in the box thing, which they also do in David Lynch's Dune. But it was a really powerful scene. But then we get to see her with the Emperor's daughter, played by Florence Pugh, and you're like, oh, she's evil. Like, she's on another level of manipulation. These people think in centuries, you know, not years or decades. They are they're thinking generationally about what they're going to do. Because remember, Paul was not supposed to be a boy. And she was kind of miffed about that.
You're mentioning their breeding program, which, I mean, think about that.
You got like eugenics in there, yeah. And, you know, stuff like that. Like, you know, that's like Nazi level evil. I kind of also wonder, you know, it's very Machiavellian. You know, it's very like the power behind the throne. The other thing that in terms of the characters was like I think everybody pretty much gets to shine, and you see everybody's perspective. Everybody there has different motivations for being there. Like, I was really impressed with the character arc that they gave some of these characters. Mm-hmm. Like, Paul actually gets a character arc. He's not just a figurehead or like, oh, you know, because how many times have we seen a movie like The Prophesied One or The Chosen One? But he actually gets to be conflicted about it, and very convincingly, you know. It was powerful, and it was really well done.
One of the things I loved about this is the fact that Denis Villeneuve, he's challenging the audience to basically say, Paul is the hero because he's taking the hero's journey, but what about him actually makes him heroic? Between him and the Reverend Mother that Charlotte Rampling plays, we get a very real firsthand lesson in how power corrupts. We get to see it play out almost in real time. And yeah, we root for Paul because he's the underdog, because his family is the one that got targeted. But he does take some actions that may end up being a net positive, but certainly aren't heroic in the moment. Again, a tremendous amount of nuance in the storytelling on this that just absolutely blows me away.
And then you get the power of the Emperor, played by the almighty Christopher Walken, who I was very happy did not go full Walken in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, the last thing, like, if he had been like, I'm the Emperor, like, if he had gone full Walken, it would have just taken everybody out of it. But
who is this Muad'Dib that you speak of? Is Paul Atreides somehow alive?
We gotta take down the Fremen. You know, it would have been, you know, I mean, talk about memes. But like, I think people kind of forgot that Christopher Walken can act. You know, he's an Oscar winner. You know, yeah. He won an Oscar for Deer Hunter years ago, but he can actually play characters when he's not just doing the Christopher Walken thing. I think they use him sparingly and in the right amounts. And Florence Pugh also gets some nice moments as well, besides looking just kind of freaky gorgeous in that headdress thing that they had her up in. That thing was amazing.
If I ever go to a convention and someone cosplays that dress properly, I will propose on the spot. I'm just going to put it out there.
Well, and let's talk about the real scene stealer here, who is Austin Butler as Fade Rautha. Oh, he's so amazing. Fade is charismatic and psychotic as all get out. A casual killer, and you know, all the Harkonnen are pale and bald, but he also has his teeth blacked out, and when he opens his mouth, it's just so freaky, and his performance is way out there. He performs in these rigged gladiatorial contests on the Harkonnen homeworld, Gedi Prime, Bill, you mentioned the stark black and white of those scenes. They actually filmed those in infrared with a special camera. So there's none of the gray tones of regular black and white film. It's amazing to watch. But then Austin Butler is amazing to watch. And yet they give him a vulnerability. The Bene Gesserit kind of go after him as maybe an alternative to Paul. And they they have this whole dossier on him. And they say that he is vulnerable around issues of humiliation and pain, you know, and you see a moment of that and you go, oh, wait, this psychotic guy even has his own weaknesses. So all of the characters are really fleshed out.
I mean, in fairness, if Lea Seydoux came on to me, I'd have a hard time thinking straight as well. But no, I absolutely love Austin Butler's performance here. Like in the first film that David Lynch did, Sting plays Fade Ralpha, and it's a pure camp performance. It's there to be so bad it's good, and you just kind of, you know, Mystery Science Theater love to laugh at it. Here he's a serious character. He's just as nuts. He's just as out there, but there's this weird, committed, insane dignity to him. I remember, like, I had to check myself multiple times because the way Butler plays him, especially when he's, like, walking solitary through the hallways and lowering his head just like this, but looking up, I saw Bill Skarsgård's Pennywise with the hair removed. That's how creepy, intense he was. But again, all of it germane to his character, to the story as it's presented, and with a motivation that he comes by honestly. Like you said, he's vulnerable to humiliation because he's the second fiddle to Dave Bautista's character. You know, he's the skinnier one. He's not as intimidating a presence physically. So you might underestimate him as a strategic threat, as a tactician, and as a lethal force. So he dedicates himself to proving everyone wrong. I mean, it's massive foreshadowing when he finishes the gladiator battle and whispers, "You fought well, Atreides," to his last victim. You know that's going to come back on him, even if you don't know the story. That's just basic scripting 101. But you also know that when it comes back, it's actually going to have impact. And again, given the just pure bonkers interpretation that Sting gave 40 years ago, that is immense. I have just loved watching Austin Butler develop as an actor. Between this, between Elvis, and as audiences will get to see in June in The Bike Riders, the man is extremely versatile.
And immersive into those characters.
Exactly.
I saw him on a talk show and they were talking about, you know, the design of the character, and he was wearing this sort of like bald cap with an appliance for his eyebrows because he doesn't have eyebrows either, which just makes everybody look weird. And I got some serious, I think, you know, I got some serious like Slytherin moments from him. Like at one point I thought he spoke Parseltongue. Like he's got like a weird affect to his voice. What I also love about him is how he's the polar opposite of Paul. And that is very much Empire Strikes Back and Star Wars, where all the good guys are like in earth tones and browns and greens and stuff, and all the bad guys are stark black and white. Does anybody know if the next movie is green lit? Do you know if we got
not officially, but it's going to be. It will be.
Denis Villeneuve is writing the script right now, and apparently won't be green lit until the script is completed.
I don't know anything about the next one. This one I thought left in a great place. I'm really glad they didn't try to make this one movie. My one probably criticism of it is that it's almost too much for one film. You know, like part two itself is too much. To me, it's almost too much. First of all, it's damn near 3 hours. There was no intermission, you know, and I had a large soda. It's not logistically, it's not great. But other than that, you must see it in a theater, I think. Because like I said, when I saw the first one, I was like, oh, this is, you know, this is pretty good. But I had the same complaints. There's a lot of table setting. It's a little bit slow. I feel like I'm reading the cliff notes of a movie kind of thing. And then, you know, but the second one, you're right in the, you know, you get thrown right into the action. I also found with the second one, I don't know if it's because it was more action oriented, but I was definitely more engaged with the characters. I did not care about the characters in the first movie all that much. I felt like I was, you know, watching this big story unfold, and I was certainly appreciating things from a technical perspective, but I don't feel like I I didn't feel like I watched a movie kind of thing. I don't feel like I got the story or the pathos or the catharsis with the characters. This time around, I did.
It's appropriate that you mention Empire Strikes Back, because when I was watching this, I very much got an Empire or Godfather Part 2 vibe from it, in the sense that this is that rare sequel that arguably outdoes its original in terms of overall quality. And with the high likelihood of a third installment, if there's any one flaw to be had with this movie, is, are we going to get Return of the Jedi or are we going to get Godfather 3? That's my biggest concern at this point. And that's a testament to how great this film is, because if that's the only thing I'm worried about when I come out of this thing in 2 hours and 45 minutes, you've done your job.
All right, I think that's a great place to wrap up. This was great, guys. I'm really glad that we took the time to talk about this movie, because I feel like it warranted. I feel like we have talked about three movies, essentially. You know, hopefully we'll get part three and we can do this again, because, you know, I'm really digging these movies. So, Mary Beth, we can read your reviews on NoRestForTheWeekendPodcast.com. We really appreciate you. You did a great job on this review. It got really good feedback online. And Bill, for people who want to find your stuff, where can they find you online?
You can find me at actuallypaid.com, where I have also reviewed this film. It's my first A of the year. And you can find me on YouTube at actually_paid. Same thing on the tweets. And I even have my blog repurposed onto Medium. So there's tons of places you can find me, including right freaking here.
One last question before we go. A quick poll. First, we're only in the first quarter of the year. Is this the best movie so far of 2024?
Yeah.
By a country mile.
And that's all we got for you today. Thanks so much for taking this trip down the rabbit hole. For more of our content, including more movie reviews, visit our website, NoRestForTheWeekendPodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast app or on YouTube, youtube.com/getbehindtherabbit. I'd like to thank Mary Beth Thewison and William Hammond and our sponsor, JMR Rentals. For Behind the Rabbit Productions, I'm Jason Godby. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.